episode 648 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Marvel Monday episode. It's also a 12 Days of the Comic Source episode. We're giving away a variant cover for Life of Captain Marvel number one. It's the Art Germ cover, so if you retweet the tweet that announces this episode, as well as direct message us the code word, you can win a copy of Captain Marvel, or Life of Captain Marvel, I should say, issue number one with that Art Germ variant. Really cool cover, so I highly encourage everybody to take a shot, try to win. So let me go ahead and dive into the books that we're going to talk about on this episode. There's been a lot of really good Marvel books come out lately. We've had a few miniseries come to an end. In fact, Life of Captain Marvel finished up with issue 5 recently, as well as the final issue number 6 of Infinity Wars. So let me start with Life of Captain Marvel. It's written by Margaret Stoll. We have pencils for the present day by Carlos Pacheco. We have inks in the present day by Rafael Fontarez. Colors for the present day by Marcio Menez and Frederico Blee. The art for the flashbacks is by Marguerite Savage. We have letters by Clayton Cowles. So we saw recently in the series that Carol had gone back to her hometown to kind of get her bearings. While she was there, she learned that her father had been writing love letters to another woman. Come to find out, that woman was Carol's mother all along. And not only that, Carol inadvertently set off a Kree tracking device when she discovered the letters, which brought a Kree cleaner, as they were called, to Earth. And when the Kree soldier, the Kree hitman, for lack of a better term, hit woman showed up, Carol just assumed that that Kree soldier was there for her. But unbeknownst to her, she was actually there for Carol's mother. And that really is the biggest takeaway from this series. What Margaret Stoll and the rest of the creative team have done is they've added to the origin of Carol Danvers, Miss Marvel, now Captain Marvel. And what we have found out is that she wasn't granted her powers by that explosion many, many years ago that she was engulfed in along with the original Captain Marvel. You know, the original origin was, okay, so Carol was in this explosion and somehow that fused some of Captain Marvel's DNA with Carol Danvers' DNA and it gave her these powers. Well, now what we've come to learn through this story and learning that Carol's mother is a Kree warrior in her own right and she had a mission to come and spy on Earth. And when she came, she met Carol's father, fell in love, and eventually had a family and realized that that was her calling. Her calling was to raise Carol in the, you know, in the Kree speak, Carol, as we would say it. But that became her life, being a mother, raising this other warrior. And so unbeknownst to Carol all this time, what that explosion that she was caught in with Captain Marvel did was it just unlocked her already present Kree DNA and unlocked the powers. And it helped really to kind of explain why Carol always felt different from a very young age, why she always strove to fly higher and faster and be more than just another Air Force pilot. So you know, there have been times where things have been retconned and they haven't made a whole lot of sense. And it feels like they're just changing it for the sake of changing it, or a writer's changing something to line up more with a TV show or movie, things like that. Sometimes silly things like changing the name of Infinity Gems to Infinity Stones. It just doesn't feel necessary, right? Like if you want to make a different version for the movie screen or the TV screen and because it makes more sense and it's simple, I don't really have that much of a problem with it at this point. It used to bother me more, but it's so ubiquitous. It happens so much now. It's kind of, it's like whatever, right? We can just take that as a different version. Sometimes you need to simplify things for people who aren't familiar with the comics or they don't understand. They're not willing to invest the time, whatever. You know, you're trying to make it simple for the and appeal to lowest common denominator. I get that, right? These comic book publishers are all owned for the most part now by these giant conglomerations, international corporations are trying to make money. So if they've got to simplify things, I get it. I understand the reason why, even if there doesn't seem to be a necessary reason for it. And I hate to sound like I'm beating a dead horse, but going back to that whole Infinity Gems versus Stones thing, like I just no reason to change it. It's just dumb. But anyway, if they want to change it for the movie or TV, so be it. But what I don't get is when they then retroactively apply that to the comics, right? So if you put all the X-Men in black leather costumes, for example, because you think the bright, colorful original X-Men costumes in the comics will look silly on the big screen. Okay, whatever, that's your choice. That's fine. But then don't go back and change cool costumes in the comic to be simple black leather boring costumes, because the colorful costumes have worked all this time in the comics. Why change it? If it's not broke, don't fix it. That's where it starts to bother me, when they change things for the sake of movie, TV, to get to the lowest common denominator and simplify things, but then they retroactively apply that to the comics. That's when it starts bugging me. It's like, this has worked all these years in the comics. Why are you switching it, right? So the fact that they've changed this origin to Captain Marvel, you might think, oh, well, that's going to, you know, bug me to some extent. But actually, it doesn't, because they're not actually changing anything. They're just adding to what's already there. They're not changing the fact that there was an explosion. They're not making any changes to that. They're not really changing who Carol is as a person. They're not changing anything that's really central or core to the character. But it is a pretty big change when you think about it in terms of how it might affect Carol going forward. And so I think in that way, it's okay, because it's additive and it makes sense. And whether or not it plays into her origin in the movie or not, I guess we'll have to wait and see. We're still a few months out from that. And I did enjoy the fact that they made this change and it was additive, and I felt like it didn't take away from who the character was, and it brought her in a way closer to her family. So all that being said, when the events of issue 5 play out, we see Carol fighting alongside her mother for the first time. We see the fact that she shares so much more in common with her mom than she ever knew. And from what we saw previously in the first 4 issues, there seemed to be sort of a disconnect with Carol and her mom. They didn't seem to be as close as they possibly could be. Carol kind of looked at her mom as somebody that maybe she didn't have that much in common with, her she didn't connect with. And so that's what makes ultimately what happens in issue 5 even more tragic. And, you know, not to get too spoilery, this issue has been out for a little while now, but her mom doesn't survive the Kree cleaner coming back to find her. And if there's anything about the story that I didn't really like, it was that. It just seemed a little cliche, you know, like we've seen that story 100 times where, you know, a mother or a child finds out something about one of their parents that is like kind of like a deep secret, but something that would bring them close together. And right on the heels of finding that out, the parent's taken from them in one way or another, and they never really get to connect and have a close relationship like they possibly would. And I think, I don't know. I understand that it makes for a more impactful story, and it leaves Carol in a different place, and probably in the place that Marvel editorial wanted her to be going forward with the new Captain Marvel story. But it just would have been kind of refreshing to see it go the other way rather than have it be this kind of same old tired cliche and have Carol and her mom start bonding, right? Like, not that I thought her mom was going to become, you know, an Avenger and be fighting elbow to elbow with her, but she could have learned so much from her mother. They could have at least bonded. They could have had more time together. So it's a small quibble. I think overall the story from start to finish, these 5 issues have been very enjoyable. It's not an action-packed, you know, typical Marvel story, I would say. It's so much more than that from Margaret Stoll. It's very much a story about emotion and family and belonging, right? And it really is something special. It's really lightning in a bottle when it comes to telling a story set in the Marvel Universe about one of its most well-known characters. And Captain Marvel's about to be so much more well-known once the movie hits. And to tell a story about a hero that's as well-known as Captain Marvel is, that's as important to the Marvel Universe as Captain Marvel, but tell a story about her family and about the dynamics, the relationships, both the good and the bad of that family is something that we don't see every day. So ultimately, I think it was a very good story, bordering on great. And as far as the high concept for the series, that was definitely great. Also, I've got to call out the art. Carlos Pacheco and the Marguerite Sauvage flashbacks for the whole series and this issue in particular are done very, very well. The final page with Carol flying off into space is something really special. Just the look on her face, the beautiful background, which has a lot to do with the actual colorist. You know, when you're doing backgrounds of space, it's not typically the artist that does that. So got to give credit to Marcio Menez and Frederico Blee for that. But overall, the art was spectacular. The colors are really done well. Love the flashbacks, how it seemed to be a little Norman Rockwell-esque when you talk about kind of the overall feel of Marguerite Sauvage's art for the flashbacks. So all in all, I really recommend this Life of Captain Marvel series. I think it sets up Carol very well for both the movie and the new series from Kelly Thompson going forward. And if you haven't picked up the single issues, I definitely recommend picking up the trade paperback. And be sure and retweet the tweet for this episode and send us the code word that's going to allow you to get your hands on the Art Germ variant cover for issue one of this series. All right, the next book I'm going to talk about is the Defenders one-shot called The Defenders, The Best Defense, Number One. This one-shot plays out of the four previous one-shots that each focused on one of the original members of the Defenders. So we had Doctor Strange, we had the Immortal Hulk, we had Silver Surfer, and then Namor the Submariner. Now, I thought that those four one-shots were leading into a new ongoing Defenders, but it's actually just those four one-shots leading into this one story. And I don't know, maybe Marvel's trying to gauge interest in a Defenders story or Defenders title. Like, how well will this be received? Will that allow them to perhaps launch a Defenders series later on? Maybe it's not the best time to launch a Defenders series because of what's going on with the Hulk and Doctor Strange currently. But I did appreciate more than ever the recap page in this issue because it helped to put into context those four one-shots, which I did read. And I think I rank them as the Doctor Strange one number one, Namor a close second, Immortal Hulk third, and Silver Surfer one I did not like at all. And in fact, in reading these recaps, I got much more of kind of a perspective and understood what happened. I read the recap for the Silver Surfer. I'm like, oh, wait, that's what was happening in that issue? Because I did not get that at all. But when you read the recap, it does kind of tie them in to each other. And you kind of have an idea of what's going on. And the one thing that I didn't necessarily notice about this issue was the hooded figure that we saw in the one shots who was going around killing people. And it even says here in the recap, and inside the train itself, something in a bedsheet seems to be murdering a lot of people. I don't know that we got anything explained to us about what was going on with that particular character in this issue. I don't remember seeing it, but this was a very enjoyable issue, and I did like where it was going. Defenders is an interesting title because these aren't really characters you necessarily would think would go together, right? You've got Doctor Strange, the Sorcerer Supreme of Earth. You know, that's solely magic-based. Then you've got the Hulk, you know, kind of a mindless – at this time he's not, but in general, you know, mindless brute, a lot of strength, not a lot of intellect there. You've got Silver Surfer who – you know, originally as he was created by Stanley and Jack Kirby, kind of a Shakespeare of the spaceways, cosmic, tragic figure who has all this power but just wants to regain his humanity. Very much, as I said, a Shakespearean type character. And you've got Namor the Submariner, always arrogant, antagonistic, not a hero in the traditional sense. So they aren't really characters that you would think necessarily would work teaming up. So the Defenders, to me, the original Defenders was always such an incongruous group that you wondered how they ever really made it work. So I like the idea of Marvel bringing the original Defenders back through their own one-shots that you could read in any order, despite some of them being a little more dense and harder to understand. But what we do gain from reading those one-shots is we understand that there's a Doctor Strange, an astral projection of Doctor Strange that's come back from a possible future, and he's trying to avert disaster. We saw the Hulk discover the Eye of Agamotto and discover that astral projection. We saw in the Doctor Strange one-shot the actual possible future that Doctor Strange was trying to prevent. We also saw Namor travel far beyond our world through some kind of a portal, wormhole, whatever, in the sea to get to another world where Atlanteans had settled and try to claim them as their own, as the king of Atlantis, and that not really work out too well for him. And then we saw in the Silver Surfer issue, and this was again was one I just didn't really catch, didn't really understand what was going on. Apparently Silver Surfer is helping Galactus again. I don't know if he's fully a herald of Galactus again, but he's certainly helping Galactus find sustenance, looking for worlds that are uninhabited for Galactus to absorb so he can continue to exist. But we also saw at the end of that Silver Surfer issue that there's some kind of cosmic train that's going on, and it's that train itself which causes the disaster, that possible future that Doctor Strange is from, that he's so determined to stop that he sacrifices his physical form and is able to send his astral form back in time to try to prevent that disaster. And that's where this first issue picks up, ties in with some of the other one-shots very well. And we meet the conductor of the train. And this train, I'm not exactly sure why it exists, but what we do know is it's an engine of planets, basically. It's a juggernaut of living worlds. It's heading through space. It captures new worlds as it's going through space and uses them as fuel for its furnace. So in a way, it's a train of destruction, an engine of destruction. And the conductor scoops up those worlds as they encounter them and feeds them to the furnace. But it's been taken over by a being that I'm not familiar with. A being that was at one time dead, but has made a deal with some beings of the underworld to be reborn. And that that undead thing is called Nebulon, and it has basically taken over the mind of this conductor, and it's using the train for its own ends. And basically what's happened is these beings of the underworld have made a deal. They have borrowed, in order to gain power, many billions of souls from Mephisto. And their plan is to cause the destruction of Earth. When they cause the destruction of Earth, there will be 7 billion souls that hit the markets all at once, so to speak. So all of a sudden, you know, they've borrowed 2 billion souls from Mephisto, and they've used the power of those 2 billion souls to buy themselves prestige and status in the underworld. And so if they can destroy the Earth, then all of a sudden 7 billion souls hit the market. They're going to be able to get those souls at a much cheaper rate, basically, like, you know, selling short in the stock market, and be able to repay Mephisto the 2 billion souls they borrowed, plus have plenty of other souls left to maintain this new status they've gotten for themselves, as well as profit off of that. So that's the whole reason this thing is happening. So it's kind of interesting, the juxtaposition that Al Ewing has created here. And that reminds me, as I say that, I didn't give the creative team. This is written by Al Ewing. We've got pencils by Joe Bennett, inks by Bellardino Bravo, and colors by Dono Sanchez Almara, with letters by Clayton Cowles. So yeah, it's interesting, this juxtaposition that Al Ewing has created here, this cosmic being of or this cosmic train that's an engine of destruction, this conductor that's kind of directing the train, Nebulon having taken over the conductor and now steering the train. And all along, Nebulon has made a deal with these underworld beings, who they themselves made a deal with Mephisto. So it's plans within plans, and it's this great esoteric idea of this cosmic train of destruction juxtaposed with this idea of basically playing the stock market, right? Like supply and demand and everything that goes with that. How much more mundane can you get? So it's up to Doctor Strange, with the help of the Hulk, Silver Surfer, and Submariner to stop Nebulon. Ultimately, they are able to do that, and not in a way that Nebulon necessarily expects. He certainly doesn't expect to lose the fight, especially because they basically sick the Hulk on him as a distraction. And at the speeds and the distances that this train is traveling, even the slightest change, which Doctor Strange is able to cause the conductor just ever so slightly to have a spasm, that at these speeds and at these distances, that little spasm throws the train off just enough so that it's going to miss Earth completely. Meanwhile, the Silver Surfer has rescued Namor from his plight in space, and with a sacrifice from one of the leaders of Vodan, the Queen of Vodan herself, Silver Surfer is able to prevent the world of Vodan from being destroyed. And ultimately, the issue ends with Doctor Strange, this future possible version of Doctor Strange, being captured by Mephisto. And Mephisto thinking that, you know, you allowed yourself to be captured. You see my domain as some safe harbor for your time-lost soul. And you think you might escape and live again. But you've tricked yourself, because there is no escape. You're powerless, dead, and damned. No longer even the true Stephen Strange. Nobody will bother to remember you. No team is coming to save you. And it ends with a look on Doctor Strange's face of, fortunately, I have a plan, and maybe he knows more than we do. So, all in all, a really enjoyable story. What this future astral form of Doctor Strange, where we might see him return, will be interesting. I'm not sure why Marvel feels the need to bring in these, you know, we've got Old Man Logan, we've had Old Man Hawkeye, and now we're seeing Old Man Doctor Strange, I guess. I'm not sure why they feel the need to tell the stories of these older versions of the characters, but what Mark Waid is doing in the regular Doctor Strange title has been really interesting, but I did enjoy what this Doctor Strange brought to the table. So if there's more to his story, I'll probably enjoy reading that as well. But ultimately, this Defenders one shot was very impressive to me. It was much more than I expected. I loved how it brought in the elements of the four one shots and told a really fun story. It highlighted, as I said, that how these four characters don't necessarily work really well together in terms of on paper, like seeing who they are as characters and what their powers are and kind of what their little corner of the Marvel Universe is, you wouldn't necessarily expect them to work well together. And even in this story, they each kind of have their role to play, and they're not necessarily working together as a team. I mean, if anything, Strange is kind of pulling the strings on everybody, uses the Hulk as a distraction, uses Silver Surfer and Namor. They're kind of off on their own, teaming up to save Vodan, and the Earth is saved in the long run. But we might see this train return at some point. But loved the juxtaposition of the cosmic and the esoteric with this idea of playing the stock market of souls. And so ultimately, it just worked. It worked really well, even though these characters aren't necessarily characters that would work in a traditional team environment. They're not characters that really get along or complement each other that well. So this was like the perfect type of story to tell with these characters. I think Al Ewing has a really good grasp on each of the four and how to get the most into a story by allowing those characters to be true to themselves. So all in all, a very impressive end to a pretty enjoyable story. Silver Surfer has always been a favorite of mine. I think of these characters, Hulk is obviously my favorite, but Silver Surfer is definitely second. And so that's why I was so disappointed. That Silver Surfer one-shot was just a mess. I just did not care for it. So that was a bit disappointing. It could have been so much better. All right, let me move on to the next book I'm going to talk about. It's the end of the Infinity Wars story, the Infinity Wars 6-issue miniseries. It's from writer Jerry Dugan. We have art by Mike Diodato Jr., colors by Frank Martin, and letters by Corey Petit. And what we saw in this issue, the continuing saga of the Infinity Stones, or gems, as they should be called. And, you know, Thanos continues to be a really popular character. And ultimately, I don't think we're going to see an end to stories about the Infinity Gems anytime soon. You know, they were off the table for a long time. They came back in 1990 with the Infinity Gauntlet story. And then ever since then, that miniseries did so well. Ever since then, they haven't been too far off of the stage. And now that we've had the Infinity Wars movie that did really well for the MCU, every time Marvel gets a chance, they're going to run one of these kind of events. There's never not going to be a title that's got Thanos in it, or a title that focuses on the Infinity Gems. They're always going to be going to that well to tell stories because people seem to be interested in it. So in this most recent story of the Infinity Stones, we saw that Doctor Strange had called together the current wielders of the stones once they discovered that Thanos had been murdered by this new being named Requiem, and they found out that Requiem was actually Gamora. Part of Gamora's soul had been trapped in the Soul Stone, and she was looking for a way to become whole again. And she basically took control of all the stones, and kind of taking a page out of her father's book, she halved the universe, but in a different way. Her father had, you know, snapped his fingers and half of the beings in the universe died. Well, what Gamora did was she folded it in half. She ended up creating a new universe within the Soul Stone where there were combinations of characters. So basically by folding it in half, she merged characters together. So we had like the Soldier Supreme, I think it was called. It was like Doctor Strange and Captain America. We had a Thor Iron Man mashup. We had a Moon Knight Spider-Man mashup. And they each had their own individual miniseries. I didn't read any of those. I just read this main story. So we also saw in the story that Loki was looking for a way to steal the stones and escape to the Quarry of Creation, where he's looking for answers about the nature of the cosmos. And it almost seems like he's looking for answers about himself, like meaning of life type stuff. Or is it just Loki being Loki looking for power? And when Loki gets trapped in the Soul Stone himself, he's actually able to put together a team of heroes from across the dimensions that are able to band together and stop Gamora. And in the midst of that battle, Loki is able to steal all the stones and get to the Quarry of Creation. But when he gets there, what he finds out is that the stones don't have any power there. And so he ends up taking the stones back to that team of heroes that he put together and ends up leaving, saying, well, I've received my usual drubbing. So he sort of exits stage left. Ultimately, it's up to Adam Warlock to save the day. With the power of the stones, he's able to not only put the normal Marvel Universe back as it's supposed to be, he's also able to use the power of the stones to save the Warp world. So I guess Marvel decided that the characters in the Warp universe were popular enough that they wanted to save them and perhaps bring them back in another event, or maybe they'll come out with a, who knows, some kind of a Warp world title where they keep telling the stories of those characters from the Warp world. There's a couple of other big things that happen in this event that are of note. Drax ultimately sacrifices himself as a way to save the normal Marvel universe as well as the Warp universe. Basically, Arthur Douglas, who was one half of Drax and Drax, the Destroyer persona itself, there are always sort of two souls in one being. They basically are the ones that hold the portal together, a portal within the soul gems that allow the normal world as well as the Warp world to be put back where they're supposed to be in as it pertains to the normal world, and put in a place of safekeeping in terms of the Warp universe. But ultimately they have to sacrifice themselves because they've got to hold those portals open. If they let go of the portals to escape themselves, the portals will collapse and the worlds will be destroyed. So ultimately we lose Drax the Destroyer in this series, which is an interesting decision to let him go by the wayside. He's been a pretty popular character. He's been around for a really, really long time and made very popular by the Dave Bautista portrayal in the MCU. So interesting choice by Marvel editorial to have Drax make the ultimate sacrifice. The other big takeaway from this series, and this is probably even more impactful than what happened with Drax, is that once Adam Warlock has all the stones within his grasp, he talks of avoiding the temptation of doing what everyone else has done when they've had all those stones, which is basically, here comes the conflict again, right? You have all the stones, and all of a sudden, everybody starts fighting for them, right? The stones can rewrite history, they can rewrite reality, they can rewrite an ending and beginnings and everything. But what Adam Warlock ultimately does is he gives all the stones sentience. He gives them all souls in a way. He basically makes them their own living beings and then sends them off to decide on their own, each of them individually, what's best for that particular stone or gem. So it certainly is a way to tell more stories of the stones or the gems, and a way to tell new stories that aren't tied. I mean, how many times can you tell a story about somebody's collected all the stones and now they're going to rewrite reality, right? Like, they've done it. I mean, even this one here with Gamora, you know, the way they switch it up was, well, she didn't destroy half of the universe. She folded it in half and now there's mashups. I mean, they've pretty much come to the end of their rope when it comes to ideas of what stories to tell. But now that you have these stones as their own sentient beings, what might come of that? It is some new ground to tread, at least, and hopefully get some new stories. Will they all be benevolent? Will they be evil? Will they be complacent? Will they be indifferent towards humanity? There's a lot to be explored there. So I would say that's the biggest takeaway from the series overall. One last thing I'll say about the series, though, is, you know, as much as I enjoyed reading it and really liked the art, and it did, the first issue especially, exceed my expectations. It was very well paced, very well scripted. Ultimately, with only 6 issues, I'm not sure if it had all the space that it needed to kind of explain everything that it needed to explain. And granted, I'm not, you know, fully up to date on all my cosmic Marvel stuff. So maybe if I was, it would be a little less confusing. But I read all 6 issues. And ultimately, when this series ended, I still was left kind of like, okay, wait, what happened? I got the big strokes, but I feel like there were things that I missed. Like, I think if I were to read like a director's cut of this story, for example, that I would ultimately get a lot more out of this story. And I don't really think that that's – I don't think you should expect your readers to be able to go to that level of dedication to understand a story. So I just think that it was – it's a little dense, and I think it could have been, with a few more issues, maybe broken down a little more so that it would be a little more easily understood. And again, maybe it's all on me. Maybe it's just my own fault for not being – caught up with Thanos and caught up with the cosmic corner of the Marvel Universe. And perhaps if I was, it would have been a little bit easier for me to understand. But I did find myself, after finishing issue 6, kind of looking around online to see if somebody wrote like a recap of the series and said, okay, here's what this meant, here's what that meant, and that kind of thing. And I didn't find one. You know, when you do a search online for Infinity Wars, which is what this is called with, plural, all that comes up is the movie stuff, which is so annoying. Whenever I look for comic information and I get the movie stuff come up, it drives me insane. It bothers me so much. It's like, I don't care about the movie. I want to read about the comic. But, you know, obviously Google is going to give you back the results that are, you know, clicked on the most or that are the most popular. So that's just the nature of the beast when it comes to how popular the movies are these days. So regardless of my get off my lawn old man attitude about the movies, that's just sort of the reality of the situation. So I would recommend this if you're a huge fan of the Marvel MCU and the Infinity Stones and Thanos. Just be aware that you've got to have a pretty good working knowledge of, you know, what's going on with the Guardians of the Galaxy, what's going on with the Infinity Stones before it. This isn't a new reader friendly series by any stretch of the imagination, because I have a tentative grasp on what's going on, but I'm certainly no expert, having pretty much been absent from the Marvel Universe for the last 10 or 15 years or so and trying to get reacquainted. So I definitely will keep my eyes out to see if I can find anything that helps explain exactly what happened in the series. Maybe it's my turn to look for a podcast myself to kind of explain what happened in this series. So if any of you out there have a good grasp on it, love to have you reach out and fill me in on what exactly I'm missing. But overall, it was an enjoyable series. I think my favorite thing about it was the art by Mike Diodato. It's a style I haven't seen him use before, and it really worked for me. And I think the color work by Frank Martin also, it's not typical color work that you would see in a big epic Infinity Stone or Infinity Gem story with really bright colors, really over the top, bombastic. It's much more muted, much more with a sense of realism. And I think it really worked for me in that way. So really, really great art. Spinning out of that Infinity Wars finale, we also have the Infinity Wars Fallen Guardian number 1. And this was written also by Jerry Dugan, with art by Andy McDonald, colors by Chris O'Halloran, letters by Corey Petit. And basically, this is kind of a companion piece, kind of an epilogue. It tells kind of the origin of Drax and what happens to Arthur Douglas, and a few pages on what happens to Drax after they sacrifice themselves in the pages of the Infinity War finale. So I'm a big fan of Drax, the original Drax. I'm not as much a fan of the Dave Bautista version. I'm a sucker for the 70s look with the big collar and the purple and the green. The new version just didn't look as cool to me. It was kind of 90s with the tattoos and everything. I preferred the 70s version, but it was great to see Adam Warlock, Groot, and Star-Lord sitting around a campfire talking about Drax and how they're going to miss their friend, and wondering where exactly in the universe he is now that he sort of sacrificed himself to save the two worlds. So it was a really enjoyable story. I think it's a must read for any fan of Drax the Destroyer. And I certainly think we haven't seen the last of him. He'll be back, I'm sure, at some point. In fact, the issue even ends with "the end for now." One other thing, last thing I'll say about the Infinity Wars event overall is we do have one more issue coming in January called Infinity Wars Infinity. And maybe when I read that, it will sort of tie up everything in a way where I'll have a little bit better understanding of what happened. And also, don't forget, as I said, I didn't read any of the lead up to Infinity Wars, Countdown to Infinity Wars, nor did I read any of the mashup, the Soldier Supreme or the Iron Hammer, the Arachnite, Weapon Hex. I didn't read any of those either. I'm not sure how much more I would have gotten out of the series had I read those. So just want to be clear on that in the interest of full disclosure. All right, next up, I want to talk about the latest issue of another miniseries that's going on at Marvel. It's Marvel Knights number 4. This is the 20th anniversary of Marvel Knights, and we've been getting a story from Donny Cates with various partners on scripting duties talking about the Marvel Knights corner of the Marvel Universe and the fact that in this version of Marvel Knights, the world's forgotten about the superheroes. We learned that Dr. Doom is somehow behind it. Kingpin is working for him. We saw that somehow Bruce Banner, probably through the Hulk, his Hulk persona, who remembers the way things should be, leaving him notes night after night, morning after morning. Bruce Banner wakes up to these notes and says, you know, Frank Castle is Punisher. Matt Murdock is Daredevil. Eventually, he takes these to Frank Castle. He's able to convince Castle. Castle's eventually able to convince Daredevil, and then they're all able to convince Elektra. And basically, they're going around trying to tell people that the world is not as it is supposed to be. In this issue, we find out exactly how that happened. We're introduced to a machine that erases all knowledge and trace of people from the world. That was, I'm not sure if it was invented by Reed Richards, but he certainly is aware of it. He tells T'Challa, the Black Panther, about it. And Black Panther's like, why haven't you destroyed this thing yet? What? And Reed says, well, there was a reason this machine was created. It saved us, all of us, from annihilation. We may need it again someday. But he entrusts it to Black Panther for safekeeping. And that's sort of where this issue starts. So as I said, Donny Cates is kind of the showrunner for the story. He's had various people help him with scripting. This particular issue... and the storytelling and the scripting is in partnership with Vita Ayala, who is a very talented comic book creator in their own right. We also have art by Joshua Cassara, colors by Matt Miller, and letters by Corey Petit. And basically, this issue is all about Black Panther, and I have to give Vita all the credit in the world when it comes to writing heroes of color. I don't know that there's a better voice out there in comics right now. Vita does a great job. I think they have such a grasp on what it means to be a person of color, especially in today's world with, you know, how divisive things have gotten. And it seems like we've taken a step back in race relations in recent years. And what they are able to do is kind of fold that in with how you would want superheroes to be portrayed in a broader sense. And so it never feels like pandering to me when they write these heroes of color. It feels very natural. And I think that as, you know, a person who's been reading for comics for a really long time, they've traditionally been written by straight white guys. And there's always been that bias. And so bringing other diverse voices in like Vita help give it a sense of evolution and a sense of moving forward and telling stories that are relevant and make sense and bringing different voices to help enhance the stories that are being told. So this was a really enjoyable issue. I've never been a big fan of the Black Panther but I like the way he's portrayed in this issue. And he has forgotten who he is, along with all the other heroes. In terms of who his name is, and the fact that was the Black Panther, and the fact that he's King of Wakanda. But what's interesting about the way he's portrayed here by Donnie and Vita is that he hasn't forgotten who he is in terms of fighting against injustice and fighting for people that need help, people that are being assaulted or persecuted or being treated unfairly. He never wavers from that. So I really enjoyed that about this particular issue. And ultimately, without the help of Daredevil or the Hulk or Elektra, he's able to start remembering on his own exactly who he is, remembering that he's King of Wakanda, remembering that he is the Black Panther, and that he'll never stop fighting. So I liked that he was able to kind of break through whatever that machine has done to all the heroes, that he was able to break through on his own. It sort of shows the strength of will that that Black Panther has on his own. And I'm not going to spoil the last page, but the last page was a holy crap kind of scene where I'm not sure what's going to happen next, but it really looks like something's about to hit the fan. It really, really looks like things are coming to a head quickly. As I said, this is issue 4. I think there are 6 issues. That would make sense with the way it's been plotted and paced so far, because it really seems like all we need to do now, next issue, is get Black Panther teamed up with the other heroes who remember who they are, have a big battle that probably has some sort of a cliffhanger at the end of issue 5. Issue 6 will get the resolution of the battle and the cleanup. That would be my expectation. So the other thing I'll say about this issue, the art by Joshua Cassara. I'm not familiar with his work. I haven't seen it before. It's a bit sketchy for my tastes. Some of the stories told in flashback, I feel that the flashback issue parts of the issue are the strength of Cassara. I think his artwork's better for that, just because of kind of the tone. There's a little bit of like digital sepia, I'll call it, in those flashback scenes that make it, that give it a sense of, hey, this is a flashback. The colors are a bit more muted. When it goes into the regular, like the regular time, it's when it's not a flashback, the lines are sharper and cleaner, but that just, it makes it more apparent that Cassara's art isn't necessarily that clean, which, again, that's just personal preference for me. His style tends to be a little sketchy, and I don't generally like that that type of art. It's just not as clean as it could be. That being said, his storytelling is very strong, and panel layouts are pretty conventional. As I said, I'm not familiar with his work, so he's probably relatively new, so it's not surprising that he would go with traditional panel layouts on the pages. But he, as I said, he does have a very strong sense of storytelling, and he does move the camera around quite a bit. This is to some extent, quite a bit of a talking heads issue. There's a lot of talking back and forth with Black Panther and his various associates as he's living in New York. And it never gets boring. It moves along at a pretty good clip. So I'll give Joshua Cassara credit for that in terms of keeping things interesting from panel to panel visually, as well as giving credit to Vita Ayala on the scripting duties for keeping the scripting and the tone and the mood pretty tight. It moves along at a pretty good clip. So really enjoying this Marvel Knights series. I wasn't reading a lot of Marvel at the time that the Marvel Knights imprint was there at Marvel, but I am really enjoying this, this look back, and a pretty interesting overall premise for this story and to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Marvel Knights. I wonder how much of this was all Kate's and how much input some of the other powers that be at Marvel had to add to this story. So, all right, last book I'm going to talk about. I always like to end these Marvel Monday episodes with a look at a Charles Soule issue of Daredevil. We started with issue one. We're going to cover the whole run. We are up to issue 14. It's Dark Art Part 5, written by Charles Soule. We have art by Ron Garney, colors by Matt Milla, and letters by Clayton Cowles. And we saw at the end of last issue that Blindspot was just on the verge of escaping from Muse. Vincent Van Gore, as he's been dubbed by the press, the very interesting new villain that Charles Soule created for this arc of Daredevil, basically a serial killer who in some ways uses the bodies of his victims or the blood of his victims to create what he considers to be art. And just as Blindspot was about to escape from the sewers, he was grabbed from behind by Muse, dropped his phone. And so that's where this issue picks up, with Frank McGee telling Daredevil, you know, just because he lost his phone doesn't mean he's in trouble. When Daredevil's convinced that Muse has him, he's very worried. He feels responsible. McGee's saying, you know, I'll put my people on it right away. New Adelan has tons of forensic tech like you wouldn't believe. We'll find him. And Daredevil doesn't want to hear it. He's like, he's a good cop. He's got the resources of an entire nation behind him. But Blindspot's in trouble for one reason and one reason only, because he trusted me, right? He was trying to help, and it's my fault. I wasn't there. I was the one that was guiding him. He was relying on me to keep him safe, and I let him go. So Daredevil sits down in the middle of the street, middle of a busy street in Manhattan, and says, I'm going to find him. And he remembers when he met Muse for the first time, how Muse was sort of a void, right? There's nothing to see, nothing to hear, smell, or feel. When he met Muse on that rooftop, Muse took everything in and he didn't put anything out. So Daredevil's basically looking for the blank spot in a way. It kind of reminds me of that early issue of Superman by John Byrne, where the Joker had kidnapped Lois Lane and put her in a lead coffin and thought it would take Superman a long time because he couldn't see lead. Well, no, he can't see through lead. So what you actually did was make it really easy for Superman to find Lois Lane, because he can just look around with his X-ray vision, and whatever he can't see through is going to stand out, right? That lead coffin's going to stand out. It's kind of the same thing here. Daredevil's opening up his senses far and wide to all of the city, drinking it all in. And where that void is, where that blank spot is, that's where Muse will be. And we see that Daredevil's pushing himself to his absolute limits here. His nose even starts to bleed. But ultimately, he's able to find where Muse is. Muse has taken Blindspot to his lair. He talks about how much creating art is torture. Talks about the sort of the unwritten contract between artist and someone viewing the art, about how there's the social contract of, or the concept that the art is just emerges fully formed from the artist, and the person observing the art just takes that as face value, doesn't think about the arduous process that the artist might have to go through, how many times fits and starts, all that kind of stuff before the art shows up. And Muse is, he's an interesting character because there's so much to him that seems to be like a thinking man's villain, right? Like he makes a lot of sense when he talks about art and when he talks about people and when he talks about the world. But ultimately, it's the medium that he works in. And he even says that himself. But people, what they don't understand is, you know, they object to my preferred medium, right? I only have so much time to work before someone manages to stop me, and I need to use every moment. And so ultimately, that's what it comes down to. He's working with human life, and that's not something that should be sacrificed, especially not in terms of art, right? It's not, I mean, what is he trying to say? All that can be interesting, and you can wonder, and you can think about it and philosophize, but at the end of the day, he's killing people, he's hurting innocent people, and that's where you've got to draw the line. So once Daredevil is able to track down Muse and Blindspot and attack, Blindspot's like, Muse rather is like, you know, we've been down this road before, so I'm not really sure what you think is going to be different. And Daredevil says, get away from Blindspot or I'll snap every bone in your body. And Muse says, okay, sure, whatever, and looks at Blindspot, and then all of a sudden it hits him, right? Like he wasn't sure in what way he was going to use Blindspot as art. You know, he'd already done so many different things, and you know, he's an artist, and he's an artist artist, and so he's always striving to do something new and different, avant-garde. And he thinks, well, you know, I think I just figured it out. Suddenly I'm feeling inspired. And he literally takes his two fingers and gouges Blindspot's eyes out, and Daredevil's just shocked, screams no. And as Muse rips the eyes out of Sam's sockets here, out of Blindspot's sockets, he says, don't you see it? Blindspot, just beautiful. He throws Blindspot down. Daredevil manages to catch him. He tells Sam it's going to be all right. And Sam says, Daredevil, something Muse said, he said that he still had time to make more art, and he had to hurry and use the blood when it was fresh before it gets thick and cloddy. He still has people here, the ones that he took for the blood mural. I think they're still alive. And this, again, shows the heroism of Blindspot. Here he is. He's just been blinded. He's just lost his eyesight. He's literally had his eyes ripped from his sockets. And all he can think about is the other innocents that are still in danger. And so he tells Daredevil, don't let anyone else die. So Daredevil pursues Muse, an unfortunate rhyme there, and ultimately he's able to stop him, and he finds himself in sort of the basement of this warehouse where Muse was hiding. And we see that all the other victims that were being drained of their blood are hanging upside down. And Muse wants to know, why do you care about these people? Don't you realize they're better off? Their lives actually mean something. I'm giving them meaning. I'm making them immortal. And as he's like, you know, you're never going to get it, Daredevil. And he cuts the rope that's suspending all these people upside down from the ceiling. And Daredevil manages to stop the crank to keep them all from falling. And as he pursues Muse out to the top of the warehouse, we see that the Inhumans, along the Inhuman Security Force led by Frank McGee, has followed Daredevil, and they capture Muse. They put him in cuffs, and McGee can tell that Daredevil's not satisfied with this. He says, he's cuffed, Daredevil. You know I have to take him in. Stay back. Don't make me do something I don't want to do. We saw in a previous issue that Muse had killed Inhumans. And when it comes to killing Inhumans, due to a lot of political things that are happening, the Inhumans get jurisdiction over any kind of human law enforcement. So McGee says he'll be punished for what he's done. I swear it. And Daredevil says, he took Blindspot's eyes, Frank. How will he be punished for that? And we see Muse hold his hand up and say, I think I can help. This is what you had in mind, right? Something like this, breaking my fingers, you know, painfully. And he breaks his own fingers and holds up the disfigured, deformed hand. And Daredevil's still not happy. He's like, what is wrong with this guy? Like, this guy is like seriously deranged. And Daredevil leans in and says, what are you? And pulls his mask off. And he appears to be human, if not creepy looking. And Muse's answer is, I'm a man in a mask. And McGee again says, don't worry, he's not going to get away. We'll make him pay for it. I'll make sure of it. And Daredevil says, well, Blindspot's still in the building. He's injured. And McGee says, no, we already have him. We already transported him to get medical attention. Inhuman science can work miracles. We might be able to do something for him. So perhaps Sam may have his eyesight returned after all. I mean, his name is Blindspot. I mean, I'm not in any way condoning what Muse did. But you wonder if that doesn't foreshadow something, if Charles Soule wasn't meaning to foreshadow or give us a clue that something like this might happen. I have to think that I mean, we're 14 issues in. I'm sure Charles had this in mind that Blindspot was going to be disfigured like this and have this disability to overcome, right? And think about if you were to become blind, Daredevil's pretty much the best mentor you could have. And can Daredevil possibly help Blindspot in terms of heightening his other senses so that he has some kind of extrasensory perception like Daredevil himself? Like there's a lot of story, a lot of possibility that's there. But again, to Blindspot's credit, showcasing his heroism, when Daredevil says, "I'm so sorry, Sam, about everything that happened," all Sam wants to know is, did Daredevil save them? He says, yes, all of them, more than 100 people. And Sam says, okay, then it was worth it. And he turns his head away from Daredevil and is taken off by the Inhumans. So very, very powerful issue. I remember the first time I read it, I was shocked by the fact that Muse blinded Sam. I mean, you just don't usually see that kind of change to a main character. I mean, that is huge to blind him. So whether or not his sight can be restored by the Inhumans, whether or not Daredevil will find some way to give Blindspot some kind of heightened senses like he himself has, it's all to still come and still be explored. And we still know nothing about Muse. We know he's been stopped for now, but what his true motivations are, what exactly his powers are, how he got his powers, all that stuff is still a mystery as well, which I kind of like. You know, be force-fed everything and get all the answers right away. It sort of takes away some of the mystery of it. If you drag it on too long, like Brian Michael Bendis, then it kind of gets annoying. But maybe there isn't much to it. Maybe it's just Muse is just crazy guy. You know, maybe he got his powers from the Terrigen Mist. Maybe that's part of the reason he chose to make an art exhibit about other Inhumans. He got powers from the Terrigen Mist. He's off his nut. He's a crazy guy, a crazy tortured artist who always had mental issues, and they were only exacerbated by gaining these Inhuman powers. I mean, it could be something as simple as that. But what one thing for sure is that Charles Soule's run on Daredevil for me is an instant classic. I think it's going to go down as one of the fondly remembered eras of the character. I think that Charles just gives Matt such a unique voice, and add in the whole lawyer connection, and I think it's really something special. And I was sad to see Charles leave the title. So we'll keep covering one Daredevil issue every Marvel Monday till we get through the whole run. So I think we've got, I think Charles wrote over 40 issues. So we've got over 30 to go, 35, 36 or so. So a long way to go, and happy to get a chance to go back and read these. Even reading this 14 again, even though I had already read it, I knew about Blindspot being blinded. It still was so impactful. It still hit me like, man, I can't believe that. Just so, because it's so sudden. It just comes out of nowhere. It's really fast-paced, compelling storytelling from Charles Soule. So as always, I highly recommend reading Charles' run on Daredevil, but do yourself a favor, go back and read it right from the beginning. So I think that's going to do it for this episode. Don't forget, as I mentioned previously, this is a 12 Days of the Comic Source episode. The secret code word for this episode is Muse, M-U-S-E. So be sure and retweet and send us that code word to win the Captain Marvel, Life of Captain Marvel variant cover by Stanley Art Germ Luau. It's number one of the five-issue limited series. So retweet the tweet that announces this episode, DM us the code word, and you'll be entered to win. So once again, I want to thank everybody for listening as always. Don't forget to tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially five-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.